president of the Chicopee Rape Prevention Society. It was even plausible. Tess's hostess had pretty clearly been not just a lesbian, but a dyke lesbian. And women of that persuasion were often not fond of men who were non-rapists. Many arsonists belong to their local volunteer fire departments, Tom observed as she turned onto her street. What's that supposed to mean? Tess asked. That you shouldn't eliminate anyone based on their public affiliations. The Knitting Society ladies would never do that. But by all means, check her out online. Tom spoke in a be-my-guest tone that Tess hadn't quite expected. It was mildly irritating. How kind of you to give me permission, Thomas, she said. 28. But when she was in her office with her computer booted up, she only stared at the Apple welcome screen for the first 5 minutes, wondering if she was really thinking of finding the giant and using her gun, or if that was just the sort of fantasy to which liars for profit, such as herself, were prone. A revenge fantasy, in this case. She avoided those kinds of movies, too, but she knew they were out there. You couldn't avoid the vibe of your culture unless you were a total recluse, and Tess wasn't. In the revenge movies, admirably muscular fellows like Charles Bronson and Sylvester Stallone didn't bother with the police. They got the baddies on their own. Frontier justice. Do you feel lucky, punk? She believed that even Jodie Foster, one of Yale's more famous graduates, had made a movie of this type. Tess couldn't quite remember the title. The Courageous Woman, maybe. It was something like that anyway. Her computer flipped to the word of the day screensaver. Today's word was cormorant, which just happened to be a bird. When you send your goodies by cormorant trucking, you'll think you're flying, Tess said in her deep pretending-to-be-Tom voice. Then she tapped a key and the screensaver disappeared. She went online, but not to one of the search engines, at least not to begin with. First she went to YouTube and typed in Richard Widmark, with no idea at all why she was doing it. No conscious one, anyway. Maybe I want to find out if the guy is really worthy of fanship, she thought. Ramona certainly thinks so. There were lots of clips. The top-rated one was a 6-minute compilation titled, He's Bad. He's Really Bad. Several hundred thousand people had viewed it. There were scenes from 3 movies, but the one that transfixed her was the first. It was black and white. It looked on the cheap side, but it was definitely one of those movies. Even the title told you so. Kiss of Death. Tess watched the entire video, then returned to the Kiss of Death segment twice. Widmark played a giggling hood, menacing an old lady in a wheelchair. He wanted information. Where's that squealing son of yours? And when the old lady wouldn't tell him, You know what I do to squealers. I let them have it in the belly so they can roll around for a long time thinking it over. He didn't shoot the old lady in the belly, though. He tied her into her wheelchair with a lamp cord and pushed her down the stairs. Tess exited YouTube, binged Richard Widmark, and found what she expected, given the power of that brief clip. Although he had played in many subsequent movies, more and more often as the hero, he was best known for Kiss of Death and the giggling, psychotic Tommy Udo. Big deal, Tess said. Sometimes a cigar is just a cigar. Meaning what? Fritzy asked from the windowsill where he was sunning himself. Meaning Ramona probably fell in love with him after seeing him play a heroic sheriff or a courageous battleship commander, something like that. She must have, Fritzy agreed, because if you're right about her sexual orientation, she probably doesn't idolize men who murder old ladies in wheelchairs. Of course, that was true. Good thinking, Fritzy. The cat regarded Tess with a skeptical eye and said, But maybe you're not right about that. Even if I'm not, Tess said, nobody roots for psycho bad guys. She recognized this for the stupidity it was as soon as it was out of her mouth. If people didn't root for psychos, they wouldn't still be making movies about the nut in the hockey mask and the burn victim with scissors for fingers. But Fritzy did her the courtesy of not laughing. You better not, Tess said. If you're tempted, remember who fills your food dish. She Googled Ramona Norville, got 44,000 hits, added Chicopee, and got a more manageable 1,200. Although even most of those, she knew, would be coincidental dreck. The first relevant one was from the Chicopee Weekly Reminder, and concerned Tess herself. Librarian Ramona Norville announces Willow Grove Friday. There I am, the starring attraction, Tess murmured. Hooray for Tessa Jean. Now let's see my supporting actress. But when she pulled up the clipping, the only photo Tess saw was her own. It was the bare shoulders publicity shot her part-time assistant routinely sent out. She wrinkled her nose and went back to Google, not sure why she wanted to look at Ramona again, only knowing that she did. When she finally found a photo of the librarian, she saw what her subconscious might already have suspected, at least judging by Tom's comments on the ride back to her house. It was in a story from the August 3rd issue of the Weekly Reminder. Brown Baggers announced speaking schedule for fall, the headline read. Below it, Ramona Norville stood on the library steps, smiling and squinting into the sun. A bad photograph, taken by a part-timer without much talent, and a bad, but probably typical, choice of clothes on Norville's part. The man-tailored blazer made her look as wide in the chest as a pro football tackle. Her shoes were ugly brown flatboats. A pair of too-tight gray slacks showcased what Tess and her friends back in middle school had called thunder thighs. Holy fucking shit, Fritzy, she said. Her voice was watery with dismay. Look at this. Fritzy didn't come over to look and didn't reply. How could he, when she was too upset to make his voice? Make sure of what you're seeing, she told herself. You had a terrible shock, Tessa Jean. Maybe the biggest shock a woman can have, short of a mortal diagnosis in a doctor's office. So make sure. She closed her eyes and summoned the image of the man from the old Ford pickup truck with the bandeau around the headlights. He had seemed so friendly at first.
Didn't think you were going to meet the Jolly Green Giant out here in the Willywags, did you?
Only he hadn't been green. He'd been a tanned hulk of a man who didn't ride in his pickup but wore it. Ramona Norville, not a big driver, but certainly a big librarian, was too old to be his sister. And if she was a lesbian now, she hadn't always been one, because the resemblance was unmistakable. Unless I'm badly mistaken, I'm looking at a picture of my rapist's mother.
29. She went to the kitchen and had a drink of water, but water wasn't getting it. An old half-filled bottle of tequila had been brooding in a back corner of a kitchen cabinet for donkey's years. She took it out, considered a glass, then nipped directly from the bottle. It stung her mouth and throat, but had a positive effect otherwise. She helped herself to more, a sip rather than a nip, and then put the bottle back. She had no intention of getting drunk. If she had ever needed her wits about her, she needed them about her today. Rage, the biggest, truest rage of her adult life, had invaded her like a fever, but it wasn't like any fever she had known previously. It circulated like weird serum, cold on the right side of her body, then hot on the left, where her heart was. It seemed to come nowhere near her head, which remained clear. Clearer since she'd had the tequila, actually. She paced a series of rapid circles around the kitchen, head down, one hand massaging the ring of bruises around her throat. It did not occur to her that she was circling her kitchen as she had circled the deserted store after crawling out of the pipe Big Driver had meant for her tomb. Did she really think Ramona Norville had sent her, Tess, to her psychotic son like some kind of sacrifice? Was that likely? It was not. Could she even be sure that the two of them were mother and son based on one bad photograph and her own memory? But my memory's good, especially my memory for faces.
Well, so she thought, but probably everyone did, right?
Yes, and the whole idea's crazy. You have to admit it is.
She did admit it.
but she had seen crazier things on true crime programs.
Which she did watch.
The ladies with the apartment house in San Francisco who had spent years killing their elderly tenants for their Social Security checks and burying them in the backyard. The airline pilot who murdered his wife, then froze the body so he could run her through the wood chipper behind the garage. The man who had doused his own children with gasoline and cooked them like Cornish game hens to make sure his wife never got the custody the courts had awarded her. A woman sending victims to her own son was shocking and unlikely, but not impossible. When it came to the dark fuckery of the human heart, there seemed to be no limit.
Oh, boy, she heard herself saying in a voice that combined dismay and anger. Oh, boy, oh, boy, oh, boy. Find out for sure if you can.
She went back to her trusty computer. Her hands were trembling badly, and it took her 3 tries to enter college trucking firms in the search field at the top of the Google page. Finally, she got it right, hit enter, and there it was, at the top of the list, Red Hawk Trucking. The entry took her to the Red Hawk website, which featured a badly animated big rig with what she assumed was a Red Hawk on the side and a bizarre smiley head man behind the wheel. The truck crossed the screen from right to left, flipped and came back left to right, then flipped again. An endless crisscross journey. The company's motto flashed red, white, and blue above the animated truck. The smiles come with the service. For those wishing to journey beyond the welcome screen, there were 4 or 5 choices, including phone numbers, rates, and testimonials from satisfied customers. Tess skipped these and clicked on the last one, which read, "Check out the newest addition to our fleet."
And when the picture came up, the final piece fell into place.
It was a much better photograph than the one of Ramona Norville standing on the library steps. In it, Tess's rapist was sitting behind the wheel of a shiny cab over Pete, with Red Hawk Trucking, College, Massachusetts, written on the door in fancy script. He wasn't wearing his bleach-splattered brown cap, and the bristly blonde crew cut revealed by its absence made him look even more like his mother, almost eerily so. His cheerful, you-can-trust-me grin was the one that Tess had seen yesterday afternoon, the one he'd still been wearing when he said,
"Instead of changing your tire, how about I fuck you? How would that be?"
Looking at the photo made the weird rage serum cycle faster through her system. There was a pounding in her temples that wasn't exactly a headache. In fact, it was almost pleasant. He was wearing the red glass ring. The caption below the picture read, "Al Strelke, President of Red Hawk Trucking, seen here behind the wheel of the company's newest acquisition, a 2008 Peterbilt 389. This horse of a hauler is now available to our customers, who are the finest in all the land. Say, doesn't Al look like a proud papa?"
She heard him calling her a bitch, a whiny whore bitch, and clenched her hands into fists.
She felt her fingernails sinking into her palms and clenched them even tighter, relishing the pain.
Proud papa?
That was what her eyes kept returning to.
Proud papa.
The rage moved faster and faster, circling through her body the way she had circled her kitchen, the way she had circled the store last night, moving in and out of consciousness like an actress through a series of spotlights.
"You're gonna pay, Al. And never mind the cops, I'm the one coming to collect."
And then there was Ramona Norville, the proud papa's proud mama. Although Tess was still not sure of her, partly was not wanting to believe that a woman could allow something so horrible to happen to another woman. But she could also see an innocent explanation. Chicopee wasn't that far from college, and Ramona would have used the Stag Road shortcut all the time when she went there.
"To visit her son," Tess said, nodding. "To visit the proud papa with the new cab over Pete. For all I know, she might be the one who took the picture of him behind the wheel."
And why wouldn't she recommend her favorite route to that day's speaker? But why didn't she say,
"I go that way all the time to visit my son"?
Wouldn't that be natural?
Maybe she doesn't talk to strangers about the Strelky phase of her life, Tess said. The phase before she discovered short hair and comfortable shoes. It was possible, but there was the scatter of nail-studded boards to think about. The trap. Norval had sent her that way, and the trap had been set ahead of time. Because she had called him? Called him and said, I'm sending you a juicy one. Don't miss out. It still doesn't mean she was involved. Or not knowingly involved. The proud papa could keep track of her guest speakers. How hard would that be?
Not hard at all, Fritzy said after leaping up on her filing cabinet. He began to lick one of his paws.
And if he saw a photo of one he liked, a reasonably attractive one, I suppose he'd know his mother would send her back by... She stopped. No, that doesn't scan. Without some input from Ma, how would he know I wasn't driving to my home in Boston or flying back to my home in New York City?
You Googled him, Fritzy said. Maybe he Googled you, just like she did. Everything's on the internet these days. You said so yourself.
That hung together, if only by a thread. She thought there was one way to find out for sure, and that was to pay Miss Norville a surprise visit. Look in her eyes when she saw Tess. If there was nothing in them but surprise and curiosity at the return of the Willow Grove scribe, to Ramona's home rather than her library, that would be one thing. But if there was fear in them as well, the kind that might be prompted by the thought, why are you here instead of in a rusty culvert on the Stag Road?
Well,
that would be different, Fritzy, wouldn't it? Fritzy looked at her with his cunning green eyes, still licking his paw. It looked harmless, that paw, but there were claws hidden inside it. Tess had seen them, and on occasion felt them. She found out where I lived. Let's see if I can return the favor. Tess went back to her computer, this time searching for a Books and Brown Baggers website. She was quite sure she'd find one. Everybody had websites these days. There were prisoners doing life for murder who had websites. And she did. The Brown Baggers posted newsy notes about their members, book reviews, and informal summaries, not quite minutes, of their meetings. Tess chose the latter and began scrolling. It did not take her long to discover that the June 10th meeting had been held at Ramona Norville's home in Brewster. Tess had never been to this town but knew where it was, had passed a green turnpike sign pointing to it while on her way to yesterday's gig. It was only two or three exits south of Chicopee. Next, she went to the Brewster Township tax records and scrolled down until she found Ramona's name. She had paid $913.06 in property taxes the year before, said property at 75 Lacemaker Lane.
Found you, dear,
Tess murmured.
You need to think about how you're going to handle this, Fritzy said, and about how far you're willing to go.
If I'm right, Tess said, maybe quite far. She started to turn off her computer, then thought of one more thing worth checking out, although she knew it might come to nothing. She went to the Weekly Reminders homepage and clicked on Obituaries. There was a place to enter the name you were interested in, and Tess typed Strelky. There was a single hit for a man named Roscoe Strelky. According to the 1999 obit, he had died suddenly in his home at the age of 48, survived by his wife Ramona, and two sons, Alvin, 23, and Lester, 17. For a mystery writer, even of the bloodless sort known as cozies, died suddenly was a red flag. She searched the Reminders general database and found nothing more. She sat still for a moment, drumming her fingers restlessly against the arms of her chair, as she did when she was working and found herself stuck for a word, a phrase, or a way of describing something. Then she looked for a list of newspapers in western and southern Massachusetts and found the Springfield Republican. When she typed the name of Ramona Norville's husband, the headline that came up was stark and to the point. Chicopee businessman commits suicide. Strelky had been discovered in his garage, hanging from a rafter. There was no note and Ramona wasn't quoted, but a neighbor said that Mr. Strelke had been distraught over some trouble his older boy had been in.
What kind of trouble was Al in that got you so upset?
Tess asked the computer screen.
Was it something to do with a girl? Assault, maybe? Sexual battery? Was he working up to bigger things even then? If that's why you hung yourself, you were one chicken shit daddy.
Maybe Roscoe had help, Fritzy said. From Ramona, big strong woman, you know. You ought to know, you saw her.
Again, that didn't sound like the voice she made when she was essentially talking to herself. She looked at Fritzy startled. Fritzy looked back, green eyes asking, who? Me? What Tess wanted to do was drive directly to Lacemaker Lane with her gun in her purse. What she ought to do was stop playing detective and call the police, let them handle it. It was what the old Tess would have done, but she was no longer that woman. That woman now seemed to her like a distant relative, the kind you sent a card to at Christmas and forgot for the rest of the year. Because she couldn't decide, and because she hurt all over, she went upstairs and back to bed. She slept for 4 hours and got up almost too stiff to walk. She took 2 extra-strength Tylenol, waited until they improved matters, then drove down to Blockbuster Video. She carried the lemon squeezer in her purse. She thought she would always carry it now while she was riding alone. She got to Blockbuster just before closing and asked for a Jodie Foster movie called The Courageous Woman. The clerk, who had green hair, a safety pin in one ear, and looked all of 18 years old, smiled indulgently and told her the film was actually called The Brave One. Mr. Retro Punk told her that for an extra 50 cents she could get a bag of microwave popcorn to go with. Tess almost said no, then reconsidered.
Why the fuck not? She asked Mr. Retro Punk. You only live once, right?
He gave her a startled, reconsidering look, then smiled and agreed that it was a case of one life to a customer. At home, she popped the corn, inserted the DVD, and plopped onto the couch with a pillow at the small of her back to cushion the scrape there. Fritzy joined her, and they watched Jodie Foster go after the men, the punks, as in, do you feel lucky, punk, who had killed her boyfriend. Foster got assorted other punks along the way and used a pistol to do it. The Brave One was very much that kind of a movie, but Tess enjoyed it just the same. She thought it made perfect sense. She also thought that she had been missing something all these years, the low but authentic catharsis movies like The Brave One offered. When it was over, she turned to Fritzy and said,
I wish Richard Widmark had met Jodie Foster instead of the old lady in the wheelchair, don't you?
Fritzy agreed 1,000%. 30. Lying in bed that night with an October wind getting up to Dickens around the house and Fritzy beside her, curled up nose to tail, Tess made an agreement with herself. If she woke up tomorrow feeling as she did now, she would go to see Ramona Norville and perhaps after Ramona, depending on how things turned out on Lacemaker Lane, she would pay a visit to Alvin, big driver Strelke. More likely, she'd wake up with some semblance of sanity restored and call the police. No anonymous call, either. She'd face the music and dance, proving actual rape 40 hours and God knew how many showers after the fact might be difficult, but the signs of sexual battery were written all over her body. And the women in the pipe, she was their advocate, like it or not. Tomorrow, all these revenge ideas will seem silly to me, like the kind of delusions people have when they're sick with a high fever. But when she woke up on Sunday, she was still in full new test mode. She looked at the gun on the night table and thought, I want to use it. I want to take care of this myself, and given what I've been through, I deserve to take care of it myself. But I need to make sure, and I don't want to get caught, she said to Fritzy, who was now on his feet and stretching, getting ready for another exhausting day of lying around and snacking from his bowl. Tess showered, dressed, then took a yellow legal pad out to the sun porch. She stared at her back lawn for almost 15 minutes, occasionally sipping at a cooling cup of tea. Finally, she wrote, "Don't get caught," at the top of the first sheet. She considered this soberly, and then began making notes. As with each day's work when she was writing a book, she started slowly, but picked up speed. 31. By 10 o'clock, she was ravenous. She cooked herself a huge brunch and ate every bite. Then she took her movie back to Blockbuster and asked if they had Kiss of Death. They didn't, but after 10 minutes of browsing, she settled on a substitute called Last House on the Left. She took it home and watched closely. In the movie, men raped a young girl and left her for dead. It was so much like what had happened to her that Tess burst into tears, crying so loudly that Fritzy ran from the room. But she stuck with it and was rewarded with a happy ending. The parents of the young girl murdered the rapists. She returned the disc to its case, which she left on the table in the hall. She would return it tomorrow, if she were still alive tomorrow. She planned to be, but nothing was certain. There were many strange twists and devious turns as one hopped down the overgrown bunny trail of life. Tess had found this out for herself. With time to kill, the daylight hours seemed to move so slowly. She went back online, searching for information about the trouble Al Strelke had been in before his father committed suicide. She found nothing. Possibly the neighbor was full of shit. Neighbors so often were. But Tess could think of another scenario. The trouble might have occurred while Strelke was still a minor. In cases like that, names weren't released to the press, and the court records, assuming the case had ever even gone to court, were sealed. "But maybe he got worse," she told Fritzy.
"Those guys often do get worse," Fritzy agreed. This was rare. Tom was usually the agreeable one. Fritzy's role tended to be devil's advocate.
Then a few years later, something else happened. Something worse. Say Mom helped him to cover it up.
"Don't forget the younger brother," Fritzy said. "Lester. He might have been in on it, too."
"Don't confuse me with too many characters, Fritz. All I know is that Al fucking Big Driver raped me and his mother may have been an accessory. That's enough for me."
"Maybe Ramona's his aunt," Fritzy speculated.
"Oh, shut up," Tess said, and Fritzy did. 32. She lay down at 4 o'clock, not expecting to sleep a wink, but her healing body had its own priorities. She went under almost instantly, and when she woke to the instant dot, dot, dot of her bedside clock, she was glad she had set the alarm. Outside, a gusty October breeze was combing leaves from the trees and sending them across her backyard in colorful skitters. The light had gone that strange and depthless gold, which seems the exclusive property of late fall afternoons in New England. Her nose was better, the pain there down to a dull throb, but her throat was still sore and she hobbled rather than walked to the bathroom. She got into the shower and stayed in the stall until the bathroom was as foggy as an English moor in a Sherlock Holmes story. The shower helped. A couple of Tylenol from the medicine cabinet would help even more. She dried her hair, then swiped a clear place on the mirror. The woman in the glass looked back from the eyes haunted by rage and sanity. The glass didn't stay clear for long, but it was long enough for Tess to realize that she really meant to do this, no matter the consequences. She dressed in a black turtleneck sweater and black cargo pants with big flap pockets. She tied her hair up in a bun and then yanked on a big black gimme cap. The bun made the cap bulge a little behind, but at least no potential witness would be able to say, "I didn't get a good look at her face, but she had long blonde hair. It was tied back in one of those scrunchy things. You know, the kind you can buy at JCPenney?" She went down to the basement where her kayak had been stored since Labor Day and took the reel of yellow boat line from the shelf above it. She used the hedge clippers to cut off 4 feet, wound it around her forearm, then slipped the coil into one of her big pants pockets. Upstairs again in the kitchen, She tucked her Swiss Army knife into the same pocket, the left. The right pocket was for the lemon squeezer 38, and one other item, which she took from the drawer next to the stove. Then she spooned out double rations for Fritzy, but before she let him start eating, she hugged him and kissed the top of his head.
The old cat flattened his ears, more in surprise than distaste, probably. She wasn't ordinarily a kissy mistress,
and hurried to his dish as soon as she put him down. "Make that last," Tess told him. "Patsy will check on you eventually if I don't come back, but it could be a couple of days."
She smiled a little and added, "I love you, you scruffy old thing."
"Right, right," Fritzy said, then got busy eating.
Tess checked her "Don't Get Caught" memo one more time, mentally inventorying her supplies as she did so, and going over the steps she intended to take once she got to Lacemaker Lane. She thought the most important thing to keep in mind was that things wouldn't go as she hoped they would. When it came to things like this, there were always jokers in the deck. Ramona might not be at home, or she might be at home but with her rapist murderer's son, the two of them cozied up in the living room, watching something uplifting from Blockbuster. Saw, maybe. The younger brother, no doubt known in college as Little Driver, might be there as well. For all Tess knew, Ramona might be hosting a Tupperware party or a reading circle tonight. The important thing was not to get flummoxed by unexpected developments. If she couldn't improvise, Tess thought it very likely that she really was leaving her house in Stoke Village for the last time. She burned the "Don't Get Caught" memo in the fireplace, stirred the ashes apart with the poker, then put on her leather jacket and a pair of thin leather gloves. The jacket had a deep pocket in the lining. Tess slipped one of her butcher knives into it just for good luck, then told herself not to forget it was there. The last thing she needed this weekend was an accidental mastectomy. Just before stepping out the door, she set the burglar alarm. The wind surrounded her immediately, flapping the collar of her jacket and the legs of her cargo pants. Leaves swirled in mini cyclones. In the not-quite-dark sky above her tasteful little piece of Connecticut suburbia, clouds scudded across the face of a three-quarter moon. Tess thought it was a fine night for a horror movie. She got into her Expedition and closed the door. A leaf spun down on the windshield, then dashed away. "I've lost my mind," she said matter-of-factly. "It fell out and died in that culvert, or when I was walking around the store. It's the only explanation for this." She started the engine.
Tom the Tom-Tom lit up and said, "Hello, Tess. I see we're taking a trip."
"That's right, my friend." Tess leaned forward and programmed 75 Lacemaker Lane into Tom's tiny little mechanical head. 33. She had checked out Ramona's neighborhood on Google Earth, and it looked the same when she got there. So far, so good. Brewster was a small New England town. Lacemaker Lane was on the outskirts, and the houses were far apart. Tess cruised past number 75 at a sedately suburban 20 miles an hour, determining that the lights were on, and only a single car, a late-model Subaru that almost screamed librarian, was in the driveway. There was no sign of a cab over Pete or any other big rig. No old Bondo-patched pickup, either. The street ended in a turnaround. Tess took it, came back, and turned into Norville's driveway, without giving herself a chance to hesitate. She killed the lights and the motor, then took a long, deep breath. "Come back safe, Tess," Tom said from his place on the dashboard. "Come back safe, and I'll take you to your next stop."
"I'll do my best."
She grabbed her yellow legal pad, there was now nothing written on it, and got out of her car. She held the pad to the front of her jacket as she walked to Ramona Norville's door. Her moon shadow, perhaps all that was left of the old Tess, walked beside her. 34. Norville's front door had beveled glass strips on either side. They were thick and warped the view, but Tess could make out nice wallpaper and a hallway floored with polished wood. There was an end table with a couple of magazines on it, or maybe they were catalogs. There was a big room at the end of the hall. The sound of a TV came from there. She heard singing, so Ramona probably wasn't watching Saw. In fact, if Tess was right and the song was Climb Every Mountain, Ramona was watching The Sound of Music. Tess rang the doorbell. From inside came a run of chimes that sounded like the opening notes of Dixie, a strange choice for New England, but then, if Tess was right about her, Ramona Norville was a strange woman. Tess heard the clump of big feet and made a half turn, so the light from the beveled glass would catch only a bit of her face. She lowered her blank pad from her chest and made writing motions with one gloved hand. She let her shoulders slump a little. She was a woman taking some kind of survey. It was Sunday evening. She was tired. All she wanted was to discover the name of this woman's favorite toothpaste, or maybe if she had Prince Albert in a can, and then go home. "Don't worry, Ramona. You can open the door. Anybody can see that I'm harmless, the kind of woman who wouldn't say boo to a goose." From the corner of her eye, she glimpsed a distorted fish face swim into view behind the beveled glass. There was a pause that seemed to last a very long time. Then Ramona Norville opened the door. "Yes, can I help you?" Tess turned back. The light from the open door fell on her face, and the shock she saw on Norville's face, the utter drop-jaw shock, told her everything she needed to know.
"You! What are you doing here?"
Tess pulled the lemon squeezer 38 from her right front pocket. On the drive from Stoke Village, she had imagined it getting stuck in there, had imagined it with nightmarish clarity. But it came out smoothly. "Move back from the door. If you try to shut it, I'll shoot you."
"You won't," Norville said.
She didn't move back, but she didn't shut the door either.
"Are you crazy?"
"Get inside." Norville was wearing a big blue housecoat, and when Tess saw the front of it rise precipitously, she raised the gun.
"If you even start to yell, I'll shoot. You better believe me, bitch, because I'm not even close to kidding."
Norville's large bosom deflated. Her lips were drawn back from her teeth and her eyes were shifting from side to side in their sockets. She didn't look like a librarian now, and she didn't look jovial and welcoming. To Tess, she looked like a rat caught outside its hole.
"If you fire that gun, the whole neighborhood will hear."
Tess doubted that, but didn't argue.
"It won't matter to you, because you'll be dead. Get inside. If you behave yourself and answer my questions, you might still be alive tomorrow morning."
Norville backed up, and Tess came in through the open door with the gun held stiffly out in front of her. As soon as she closed the door, she did it with her foot. Norville stopped moving. She was standing by the little table with the catalogs on it.
"No grabbing, no throwing," Tess said,
and saw by the twitch of the other woman's mouth that grabbing and throwing had indeed been in Ramona's mind.
"I can read you like a book. Why else would I be here? Keep backing up all the way down to the living room. I just love the Trapp family when they're really rocking." "You're crazy," Ramona said,
but she began to back up again. She was wearing shoes. Even in her house coat, she was wearing big, ugly shoes. Men's lace-ups.
"I have no idea what you're doing here, but don't bullshit me, Mommy. Don't you dare. It was all on your face when you opened the door. Every bit of it. You thought I was dead, didn't you?"
"I don't know what you're..."
"It's just us girls, so why not fess up?"
They were in the living room now. There were sentimental paintings on the walls. Clowns, waifs with big eyes, and lots of shelves and tables cluttered with knick-knacks, snow globes, troll babies, Hummel figures, Care Bears, a ceramic candy house a la Hansel and Gretel. Although Norville was a librarian, there were no books in evidence. Facing the TV was a lazy boy with a hassock in front of it. There was a TV tray beside the chair. On it was a bag of cheese doodles, a large bottle of Diet Coke, the remote control, and a TV guide. On top of the television was a framed photograph of Ramona and another woman with their arms around each other and their cheeks pressed together. It looked as if it had been taken at an amusement park or a county fair. In front of the photo was a glass candy dish that gleamed with sparkled points of light beneath the overhead fixture.
How long have you been doing it?
I don't know what you're talking about.
How long have you been pimping for your homicidal rapist of a son?
Norville's eyes flickered, but again she denied it, which presented Tess with a problem. When she had come here, killing Ramona Norville had seemed not just an option, but the most likely outcome. Tess had been almost positive she could do it, and that the boat rope in the left front pocket of her cargo pants would go unused. Now, however, she discovered she couldn't go ahead unless the woman admitted her complicity. Because what had been written on her face when she'd seen Tess standing at her door, bruised but otherwise very much alive, wasn't enough. Not quite enough.
When did it start? How old was he? 15? Did he claim he was just fooling around?
That's what a lot of them claim when they first start.
I have no idea what you mean. You come to the library and put on a perfectly acceptable presentation. Lackluster. Obviously you were only there for the money, but at least it filled the open date on our calendar. And the next thing I know, you're on my doorstep, pointing a gun and making all sorts of wild...
It's no good, Ramona. I saw his picture on the Red Hawk website, ring and all.
He raped me and tried to kill me. He thought he did kill me, and you sent me to him.
Norville's mouth dropped open in a gruesome combination of shock, dismay, and guilt.
That's not true, you stupid cunt. You don't know what you're talking about.
She started forward.
Tess raised the gun.
Nuh-uh. Don't do that. No.
Norville stopped, but Tess didn't think she would stay stopped for long. She was nerving herself up for either fight or flight. And because she had to know Tess would follow her if she tried to run deeper into the house, it would probably be fight. The Trapp family was singing again. Given the situation Tess was in, that she had put herself in, all that happy choral crap was maddening. Keeping the lemon squeezer trained on Norville with her right hand, Tess picked up the remote with her left and muted the TV. She started to put the remote down again, then froze. There were two things on top of the TV, but at first she had only registered the picture of Ramona and her girlfriend. The candy dish had just earned a glance. Now she saw that the sparkles she had assumed were coming from the cut glass sides of the dish weren't coming from the sides at all. They were coming from something inside. Her earrings were in the dish. Her diamond earrings. Norville grabbed the Hansel and Gretel candy house from its shelf and threw it. She threw it hard. Tess ducked, and the candy house went an inch over her head, shattering on the wall behind her. She stepped backward, tripped over the hassock, and went sprawling. The gun flew from her hand. They both went for it, Norville dropping to her knees and slamming her shoulder against Tess's arm and shoulder like a football tackle, intent on sacking the quarterback. She grabbed the gun, at first juggling it, then securing her grip. Tess reached inside her jacket and closed her hand around the handle of the butcher knife that was her backup, aware that she was going to be too late. Norville was too big and too maternal. Yes, that was it. She had protected that rogue son of hers for years, and was intent on protecting him now. Tess should have shot her in the hall, the moment the door was shut behind her.
But I couldn't, she thought, and even at this moment, knowing it was the truth brought some comfort. She got up on her knees, hands still inside the jacket, facing Ramona Norville.
You're a shitty writer and you were a shitty guest speaker, Norville said.
She was smiling, speaking faster and faster. Her voice had a nasal auctioneer's lilt.
You phoned in your talk the same way you phoned in your stupid books. You were perfect for him, and he was going to do someone. I know the signs. I sent you that way, and it worked out right, and I'm glad he fucked you. I don't know what you thought you were going to do coming here, but this is what you get.
She pulled the trigger, and there was nothing but a dry click. Tess had taken lessons when she bought the gun, and the most important had been not to put a bullet in the chamber that would first fall under the hammer, just in case the trigger was pulled by accident. An expression of almost comical surprise came over Norval's face. It made her young again. She looked down at the gun, and when she did, Tess drew the knife from the inside pocket of the jacket, stumbled forward, and jammed it up to the hilt in Norval's belly. The woman made a glassy, "Oh!" sound that tried to be a scream and failed. Tess's pistol dropped, and Ramona staggered back against the wall, looking down at the handle of the knife. One flailing arm struck a rank of Hummel figures. They tumbled from the shelf and shattered on the floor. She made that "Oh!" sound again. The front of the house coat was still unstained, but blood began to patter from beneath its hem onto Ramona Norval's man shoes. She put her hands on the haft of the knife, tried to tug it free, and made the "Oh!" for the third time. She looked up at Tess, unbelieving. Tess looked back. She was remembering something that had happened on her 10th birthday. Her father had given her a slingshot, and she had gone out looking for things to shoot with it. At some point, 5 or 6 blocks from her house, she had seen a raggedy-eared stray dog rooting in a garbage can. She had put a small rock in her slingshot and fired at it, only meaning to scare the dog away, or so she told herself, but hitting it in the rump instead. The dog had made a miserable "Ike, Ike, Ike!" sound and ran away. But before it did, it gave Tess a look of reproach she had never forgotten. She would have given anything to take that casual shot back, and she had never fired her slingshot at another living thing. She understood that killing was a part of life. She felt no compunction about swatting mosquitoes, put down traps when she saw mouse droppings in the cellar, and had eaten her fair share of Mickey D's quarter pounders. But then she had believed she would never again be able to hurt something that way without feeling remorse or regret. She suffered neither in the living room of the house on Lacemaker Lane, perhaps because, in the end, it had been self-defense. Or perhaps that wasn't it at all. "Ramona," she said, "I'm feeling a certain kinship to Richard Widmark right now. This is what we do to squealers, honey." Norval was standing in a puddle of her own blood, and her housecoat was at last blooming with blood poppies. Her face was pale. Her dark eyes were huge and glittery with shock. Her tongue came out and swiped slowly across her lower lip. "Now you can roll around for a long time, thinking it over. How would that be?" Norval began to slide. Her man's shoes made squittering sounds in the blood. She groped for one of the other shelves and pulled it off the wall. A platoon of Care Bears tilted forward and committed suicide. Although she still felt no regret or remorse, Tess found that in spite of her big talk, she had very little inner Tommy Udo. She had no urge to watch or prolong Norville's suffering. She bent and picked up the .38. From the right front pocket of her cargo pants, she removed the item she had taken from the kitchen drawer beside her stove. It was a quilted oven glove. It would silence a single pistol shot quite effectively, as long as the caliber wasn't too big. She had learned this while writing, "The Willow Grove Knitting Society goes on a mystery cruise."
"You don't understand," Norval's voice was a harsh whisper. "You can't do this. It's a mistake. Take me to hospital."
"The mistake was yours." Tess pulled the oven glove over the pistol, which was in her right hand. "It was not having your son castrated as soon as you found out what he was." She put the oven glove against Ramona Norval's temple, turned her head slightly to one side, and pulled the trigger. There was a low, emphatic "pluh" sound, like a big man clearing his throat.
That was all.
35. She hadn't Googled Al Strelke's home address. She had been expecting to get that from Norval. But as she had already reminded herself, things like this never went according to plan. What she had to do now was keep her wits about her and carry the job through to the end. Norval's home office was upstairs, in what had probably been meant as a spare bedroom. There were more Care Bears and Hummels there. There were also half a dozen framed pictures, but none of her sons, her main squeeze, or the late great Roscoe Strelke. These were autographed photos of writers who had spoken to the Brown Baggers. The room reminded Tess of the Stagger Inn's foyer with its band photos.
She didn't ask for an autograph on my photo, Tess thought.
Of course not. Why would she want to be reminded of a shitty writer like me? I was basically just a talking head to fill a hole in her schedule. Not to mention meat for her son's meat grinder. How lucky for them that I came along at the right time.
On Norval's desk, below a bulletin board buried in circulars and library correspondence, was a desktop Mac very much like Tess's. The screen was dark, but the glowing light on the CPU told her it was only sleeping. She pushed one of the keys with a gloved fingertip. The screen refreshed, and she was looking at Norval's electronic desktop. No need for those pesky passwords.
How nice.
Tess clicked the address book icon, scrolled down to the R's, and found Red Hawk Trucking. The address was 7 Transport Plaza, Township Road, College. She scrolled further to the S's and found both her overgrown acquaintance from Friday night and her acquaintance's brother, Lester. Big driver and little driver. They both lived on Township Road, near the company they must have inherited from their father. Alvin at number 23, Lester at number 101.
If there was a third brother, she thought, they'd be the three little truckers. One in a house of straw, one in a house of sticks, one in a house of bricks. Alas, there are only two.
Downstairs again, she plucked her earrings from the glass dish and put them in her coat pocket. She looked at the dead woman sitting against the wall as she did it.
There was no pity in the glance, only the sort of parting acknowledgement anyone may give to a piece of hard work that has now been finished.
There was no need to worry about trace evidence. Tess was confident she had left none, not so much as a single strand of hair. The oven glove, now with a hole blown in it, was back in her pocket. The knife was a common item sold in department stores all over America. For all she knew, or cared, it matched Ramona's own set. So far she was clean, but the hard part might still be ahead. She left the house, got in her car, and drove away. 15 minutes later, she pulled into the lot of a deserted strip mall, long enough to program 23 Township Road, College, into her GPS. 36. With Tom's guidance, Tess found herself near her destination not long after 9 o'clock. The three-quarter moon was still low in the sky. The wind was blowing harder than ever. Township Road branched off U.S. 47, but at least 7 miles from the Stagger Inn, and even farther from College's downtown. Transport Plaza was at the intersection of the two roads. According to the signage, 3 trucking firms and a moving company were based here. The buildings that housed them had an ugly prefab look. The smallest belonged to Red Hawk Trucking. All were dark on this Sunday night. Beyond them were acres of parking lot, surrounded by cyclone fence and lit with high-intensity arc lights. The depot lot was full of parked cabs and freight haulers. At least one of the cab overs had Red Hawk Trucking on the side, but Tess didn't think it was the one pictured on the website, the one with the proud papa behind the wheel. There was a truck stop adjacent to the depot area. The pumps, over a dozen, were lit by the same high-intensity arcs. Bright white fluorescence spilled out from the right side of the main building. The left side was dark. There was another building, this one U-shaped, to the rear. A scattering of cars and trucks was parked there. The sign out by the road was a huge digital job, loaded with bright red information.
Ritchie's Township Road Truck Stop. You drive 'em, we fill 'em. Regular $2.99 a gallon. Diesel $2.69 a gallon. Newest lottery ticks always available. Restaurant closed Sunday night. Sorry, no showers Sunday night. Store and motel always open. RVs always welcome. And at the bottom, badly spelled but fervent. Support our troops. Win in Afghanistan.
With truckers coming and going, fueling up both their rigs and themselves, even with its lights off, Tess could tell that, when open, the restaurant was the sort where chicken fried steak, meatloaf, and mom's bread pudding would always be on the menu. The place would probably be a beehive of activity during the week, but on Sunday night, it was a graveyard because there was nothing out here, not even a roadhouse like the Stagger. There was only a single vehicle parked at the pumps, facing out toward the road with a pump nozzle stuck in its gas hatch. It was an old Ford F-150 pickup with Bondo around the headlights. It was impossible to read the color in the harsh lighting, but Tess didn't have to. She had seen that truck close up and knew the color. The cab was empty.
You don't seem surprised, Tess, Tom said, as she slowed to a stop on the shoulder of the road and squinted at the store.
She could make out a couple of people in there, in spite of the glare from the harsh outside lighting. And she could see that one of them was big.
Was he big? Or real big? Betsy Neal had asked.
I'm not surprised at all, she said. He lives out here. Where else would he go to gas up?
Maybe he's getting ready to take a trip.
This late on Sunday night? I don't think so. I think he was at home watching The Sound of Music. I think he drank up all his beer and came down here for more. He decided to top off his tank while he was at it.
You could be wrong, though. Hadn't you better pull in behind the store and follow him when he leaves?
But Tess didn't want to do that. The front of the truck stop store was all glass. He might look out and see her when she drove in. Even if the bright lighting above the pump islands made it hard for him to see her face, he might recognize the vehicle. There were lots of Ford SUVs on the road, but after Friday night, Al Strelke had to be particularly sensitized to black Ford Expeditions. And there was her license plate. Surely he would have noticed her Connecticut license plate on Friday when he pulled up beside her in the Gone to Weeds parking lot of the deserted store. There was something else, something even more important. She got rolling again, putting Ritchie's Township Road truck stop in the rear view. I don't want to be behind him, she said. I want to be ahead of him. I want to be waiting for him.
What if he's married, Tess? Tom asked. What if he's got a wife waiting for him?
The idea startled her for a moment. Then she smiled, and not just because the only ring he'd been wearing was the one too big to be a ruby. Guys like him don't have wives, she said, not ones that stick around anyway. There was only one woman in Al's life, and she's dead.
Unlike Lacemaker Lane, there was nothing suburban about Township Road. It was as country as Travis Tritt. The houses were glimmering islands of electric light beneath the glow of the rising moon.
Tess, you are approaching your destination, Tom said in his non-imaginary voice.
She breasted a rise, and there on her left was a mailbox marked Strelke and 23. The driveway was long, rising on a curve, paved with asphalt, smooth as black ice. Tess turned in without hesitation, but apprehension dropped over her as soon as Township Road was behind her. She had to fight to keep from jamming on the brakes and backing out again, because if she kept going, she had no choice. She'd be like a bug in a bottle. And even if he wasn't married, what if someone else was up there at the house? Brother Les, for instance. What if Big Driver had been at Tommy's buying beer and snacks, not for one, but for two? Tess killed her headlights and drove on by moonlight. In her keyed-up state, the driveway seemed to go on forever, but it could have been no more than an eighth of a mile before she saw the lights of Strelke's house. It was at the top of the hill, a tidy-looking place that was bigger than a cottage, but smaller than a farmhouse. Not a house of bricks, but not a humble house of straw, either. In the story of the three little pigs and the big bad wolf, Tess reckoned this would have been the house of sticks. Parked on the left side of the house was a long trailer box with Red Hawk Trucking on the side. Parked at the end of the driveway, in front of the garage, was the cab over Pete from the website. It looked haunted in the moonlight. Tess slowed as she approached it, and then she was flooded with a white glare that dazzled her eyes and lit the lawn and the driveway. It was a motion-activated pole light, and if Strelke came back while it was on, he would be able to see its glow at the foot of his driveway, maybe even while he was still approaching on Township Road. She jammed on the brakes, feeling as she had when, as a teenager, she dreamed of finding herself in school with no clothes on. She heard a woman groaning. She supposed it was her, but it didn't sound or feel like her.
"This isn't good, Tess."
"Shut up, Tom."
"He could come back any minute, and you don't know how long the timer on that thing is. You had trouble with the mother. He's much bigger than her."
"I said shut up!" She tried to think, but that blaring light made it hard. Shadows from the parked cab over in the long box to her left seemed to reach for her with sharp black fingers. Boogeyman fingers. "Goddamn pole light! Of course a man like him would have a pole light!" She ought to go right now. Just turn around on his lawn and drive back down to the road as fast as she could. But she would meet him if she did. She knew it. And with the element of surprise gone, she would die. Think, Tessa Jean, think.
And oh God, just to make things a little worse, a dog started barking. There was a dog in the house. She imagined a pit bull with a head full of jutting teeth.
"If you're going to stay, you need to get out of sight," Tom said. And no, that didn't sound like her voice, or not exactly like her voice. Perhaps it was the one that belonged to her deepest self, the survivor. And the killer, her too. How many unsuspected selves could a person have hiding deep inside? She was beginning to think the number might be infinite.
She glanced into her rearview mirror, chewing at her still swollen lower lip. No approaching headlights yet. But would she even be able to tell, given the combined brilliance of the moon and that Christing pole light?
"It's on a timer," Tom said. "But I'd do something before it goes out, Tess. If you move the car after it does, you'll only trip it again."
She threw the Expedition into four-wheel, started to swing around the cab over, then stopped. There was high grass on that side. In the pitiless glare of the pole light, he couldn't help but see the track she would leave. Even if the Christing light went out, it would come back on again when he drove up, and then he would see them. Inside, the dog continued to weigh in.
"Yuck, yuck, yuck, yuck!"
"Drive across the lawn and put it behind the long box," Tom said.
"The tracks, though. The tracks!"
"You have to hide it somewhere," Tom returned. He spoke apologetically but firm. "At least the grass is mown on that side. Most people are pretty unobservant, you know. Doreen Marquis says that all the time."
"Strelke's not a knitting society lady. He's a fucking lunatic."
But because there was really no choice, not now that she was up here, Tess drove onto the lawn and toward the parked silver long box through a glare that seemed as bright as a summer noonday. She did it with her bottom slightly raised off the seat, as if by doing that, she could somehow magically render the tracks of the Expedition's passage less visible.
"Even if the motion light is still on when he comes back, he may not be suspicious," Tom said. "I'll bet deer trip it all the time. He might even have a light like that to scare them out of his vegetable garden."
This made sense, and it sounded like her special Tom voice again, but it did not comfort her much.
"Yark, yark, yark, yark."
Whatever it was, it sounded like it was shitting nickels in there.